It is Thursday, January 16th, 2020. Welcome to Menace to Sports, episode 75. Thank you for tuning in. Got a great episode for you. Really excited. A couple things that happened. Aaron Hernandez documentary came out, and I obviously knew Aaron very well from my time at Florida. So I want to talk about that, kind of him, his life, who I knew, and the Aaron that I knew, and also just some, I guess, behind the scenes account into Aaron Hernandez's life, you know, before all the shit that he got into. And then I also want to talk a little bit about Odell Beckham and LSU and kind of the scene that was the national championship game and what he did to, I guess, overtake the spotlight at the national championship game. Then we're going to talk about the game, about LSU, about Joe Burrow, about Clemson, kind of my analysis and, I guess, reaction to the game, to the season, to the national champ, the deserved national champ, probably one of the best teams to ever play college football. Then we have our special guest, our resident Clemson insider, Anna Hickey, will join us to talk a little bit about the atmosphere down in New Orleans, kind of the scene behind the scenes in the Clemson program and where they stand today, the state of Clemson, being that there are two clear-cut favorites to go to the national championship in 2020, very early favorites. But Ohio State and Clemson right now are the odds-on favorites to return to the playoffs and meet up in the championship game. So look forward to her and her interview as always. But without further ado, let's get to the show.
That's why I don't read the newspaper, because it's garbage. And the editor that let it come out is garbage.
Or do you do what everybody else in the media does, just create some shit and throw it on the wall and see what sticks, which is what I see happening everywhere.
Where are we at in society today? I'm a man, I'm 40.
When my time on earth is gone, and my activities here are past, I want they bury me upside down, and my critics can kiss my
Welcome to Menace of Sports, episode 75. I am Zach Smith. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate you taking your time and spending it with me and us. Really excited about some of the stuff we have going in this platform. Had a couple meetings today about future plans for the fall, some tailgates, some big parties to really celebrate college football and also other events. And also we're going to do some live shows coming this spring and fall and some big things on the horizon. And it's all because of your support. It's all because you hit download, you hit listen, and you subscribe on Patreon, which is a huge supporter. And also because of your social media responses. So keep that up. Really appreciate it. Feedback is always welcome. So let's talk about some current events. A couple things that have happened since we last got together. The first was yesterday, and I was going to put out an episode yesterday until I saw the Aaron Hernandez documentary came out. So I spent whatever it took, 4 hours yesterday afternoon and watched. I couldn't stop watching. I was going to watch one episode, and I watched the whole thing. So first of all, check it out on Netflix, Aaron Hernandez documentary. It's shocking, to say the least. And not too shocking, being that I knew Aaron, but I heard about everything that happened. But it really gets into what motivated him to do the things that he did, right? And I don't know that there's ever any sane reason that you could sit there and say that's why he did it, because killing someone is certainly something that is you can't rationalize or justify. But I will tell you this. I knew Aaron very, very well at Florida, probably as well as I knew any player, because he was a tight end. And tight ends generally are in that in-between, right? They're on one front, they're an offensive lineman that they need to learn run blocking, pass blocking, all these things that offensive linemen do. And then on the other front, they're a receiver, where they have to learn how to run routes, catch the ball, ball security, all those things. So tight ends are a lot of times in an in-between, where they might have more of a receiver coach and they need to learn how to block from someone. And it's tough to be a tight end coach. One of them are most versatile coaches. You have to be an offensive line coach and a receiver coach at the same time. And it's very few and far between are there great tight end coaches. And so he had John Hevesy, who's now at Florida, was his position coach, who is, I mean, well-documented. He's now an offensive line coach. He was an offensive line coach prior to. So he's a very offensive line coach mentality. So when it came to receiver play and route running, he really didn't have any expertise. And so Aaron would utilize me as a GA, the wide receiver GA, to help him in the pass game. And I remember it would be, this would have been his sophomore year and junior year. he would come early mornings, probably twice a week, 6 a.m. with myself, and they had a receiver named Carl Moore who was not playing that year. He took a red shirt because of a back injury. But once he got healthy, we started doing receiver drills in the morning at 6 a.m., and Aaron and Carl would come twice a week, and we would do it. And it's really how I got hired at Ohio State by Urban, because he saw that development and that commitment to players. And so anyways, long story short, Aaron and I developed a relationship, a coach-player relationship, and I got to know him pretty decent. And he, to the point where he came over to my house on Thanksgiving amongst his other stops with other coaches. And so he spent time with my then wife, with my grandmother, with my parents, my sister. And so obviously hindsight being 2020, it's like, whoa, that's wild. Like we had a serial killer, right? He killed multiple people, was sitting in my house talking to my pregnant wife and eating dinner with my entire extended family. So it was very bizarre to look back and think about that. But I will tell you this, Aaron was very Eddie Haskell-ish, very smart, was able to turn it on and turn it off. He was able to relate to anyone. He could relate to a coach's wife. He could relate to someone on the team that's urban area. He could relate to a kid from a suburban area. He had an ability to present himself whatever way he wanted to. And it was scary all the time. And I used to tell him he was Eddie Haskell-ish. Like he could be the nicest, sweetest, like, yes, ma'am. No, sir. If you know who Eddie Haskell is, that was Aaron Hernandez. And a lot of the stuff that they talked about in this was homosexual tendencies and kind of that place in athletics. And I will tell you this, football is touted as this tough sport, this masculine sport, the man's man sport, where people would feel very uncomfortable, coming out and saying they were homosexual. And the only thing I could relate to, I've never been around a player that was openly homosexual in a locker room. I haven't. So I can't relate to that aspect of it. But I will say this, another thing that's considered non-masculine and non-tough is talking about feelings and talking about mental illness. And I detailed it on one of our previous shows, but I believe that because of the brotherhood and because of the relationships within a team that I've experienced, much like feelings, much like mental health, things that maybe aren't considered quote unquote tough, that a thing like homosexuality would be, I don't want to say welcome, but it would be well received much more so than people believe. Because at the end of the day, there's relationships there. And it might be a little awkward or it might be a little different, but I don't think it would be as monumental as it's made out to be in people's minds. And make no mistake about it, Aaron had some homosexual tendencies, but it was always in a joking manner. I don't think he was comfortable being homosexual or displaying those things, but he was comfortable doing it jokingly to the point where it was funny. I remember one example, I went out to practice and it made me uncomfortable because it was just it was an inappropriate situation, but it was in stretch lines and I walked out and he looked at me and he said, "Hey coach, you're not wearing compression shorts." And I was like, "Excuse me?" He was like, "Man, I see that dick swanging right now." And I was like, "Jesus, man, don't say that to somebody. That is inappropriate as shit." But he used to say things like that all the time to a lot of people. And he thought it was almost in a joking manner. He used to do a lot of things that you were like, "Man, this is a different cat right here." But I will tell you this, if you've watched the show, if you need to watch it, first of all, but a bizarre story. This kid was, when he was getting recruited, had a great family. It seemed like great parents. His dad was his idol. And I don't want to spoil the documentary for you, but he went through a lot in his personal life. With the minute his dad died from a routine surgery, got an infection, passed away. Within a month or two, his mom ended up having an affair. And I guess the guy she had an affair with moved in, who was the husband of his cousin. It's just a bizarre, complicated story. And it brought me to a point, and I was wondering if they would get to it. I wonder if they uncovered it in the documentary. But he came out and told me a story. And again, I will say that he was a different cat. Like he could put on a front and he could tell you a story that you would just believe was genuine. But he told me a story. And what made me think about this was that his cousin Tanya, who was his closest person in his life, I don't know that she was his real cousin, but she passed away from cancer. And obviously Aaron passed away from suicide. And he has a daughter and a fiance that they are obviously mourning the loss of him. But he told me a story that I mean, I'll tell you this. When he told me the story, it seemed very, very real. And it came from a place of confinement. Like he told me and confided in me. And he also told one other coach who I actually talked to yesterday about it. But he told me that he actually fathered a child with his cousin Tanya. One of her kids was his. And that his mom didn't know, no one knew, and they weren't going to tell him because it would raise a lot of questions. And it got me thinking now that she's passed away, he's passed away, that there's a chance, if this story is true, that he has a child right now that doesn't know Aaron Hernandez was his dad. And just the complication of this family, how screwed up it was, is just wow. And like I said, he told me that story, and it was very genuine. I believed it. He told another coach or coaching staff member that same story. And I just wonder if this kid will ever know. And I mean, obviously I'm telling the story now, not to expose it or anything like that, but just to give you perspective into how bizarre this situation was. So very bizarre. I would encourage you watch it. Really a tragic story on so many fronts. First and foremost, the victims that were obviously lost their lives, but it's tragic too for Aaron and his family, because they obviously, he had a bright future and he was just a screwed up cat. A lot of things went wrong and it's sad, just a sad, sad situation. But that's my Debbie Downer moment of the show. Just kind of, I want to encourage you watching that documentary because it's great. The other thing that went on, Odell Beckham Jr. Wow. I've never seen an athlete take such an awesome moment in his alma mater's, history, and make it more about himself. And I'm sure everyone has seen it now. First, he's slapping handshakes, giving cash to players, and then he's in the locker room interrupting Coach O in his post game speech. And then why this police officer's in there trying to investigate what's in a Gatorade bottle is another absurdity. But then he smacks the cop on the ass. Now they announced today there's an arrest warrant out for him. It's like, my God, man, just come back, be a celebrity, hang out, and let everyone enjoy the national championship. Why do you have to make this about you? I will tell you this. In my experience, what he did with the cash exchange for a great game, that is so, so common in college athletics. I mean, everywhere I've been, I've heard about it, kind of rumors, where an NFL player would be like, hey man, I've been talking shit all week. I got 200 for you for a touchdown. And that would happen. I never saw money exchanged. I don't know that it happens all the time, but I promise you this, everywhere in the country it happens. And I really don't see any problem with it. Most of these NFL players are 2-3 years removed. Most of them know these players and they're friends. It'd be no different than when I was a football coach and my little sister got an A in a college class, and I would give her $100 and say, hey, good job. You deserve this. Like, great job. Or whatever, whoever does that. If you ever give your kid $20 to clean the bathroom, or if you ever give your friend $30 for doing a great job in a presentation, or, you know, buy them coffee, it's no different. These are friends. It's not like some 45-year-old booster comes back to give a guy $1,000 to play for LSU. You're talking about they're of the same peer group. And I will tell you this, the LSU bullshit was, oh my God, it was fake money. Shut the fuck up. Fake money. Who the fuck has fake money? Odell's just carrying around fake money. A multimillionaire's just carrying around fake hundreds to give to players to be funny. Everyone knew it wasn't fake money. Joe Burrow had the balls enough to come out and say, hey, you gave me real money. I don't know what they're talking about, but you can't do shit to me. And that's when LSU is like, oh, now we found out it is real money, but they're going to give it back. It's like, oh, man, the real issue here is he made a spectacle of it. He did it on camera in the middle of the celebration to make it about him. To, you know, and his guys, and him taking care of his guys. And it's a joke. But that is Odell Beckham. You compare the two, Odell Beckham and Michael Thomas. Michael Thomas will never make a spectacle about him. He was at the game. He hugged Joe Burrow and congratulated him. That was it. If Ohio State was in the game, Michael Thomas would not have been on the stage. He would not have been in the front and center. He would not have been in the spotlight. He would have congratulated them, enjoyed it. Probably after the game, maybe they all would have went out and he would have enjoyed some brotherhood. But never would he have been the spectacle that Odell Beckham was. And the best part is, he's a better player. That's the difference in players. That's the difference in what you want as an NFL franchise and what you don't want. The worst thing you could have is a very productive player that's an asshole. And Odell Beckham is an asshole, a big one. He's a child, punching nets, going to national championship games, giving out money, making a spectacle. Everything's about him. The Giants struggle. He's got to go punch a kicking net. Why? So the cameras would be on him. So they write articles about him. So he's center of attention. Shut your mouth and play the game and be a good dude. Is it that hard? All right, I had to get that off my chest. So I want to get into the LSU-Clemson game, kind of my analysis, just a little breakdown. It obviously was a huge victory for LSU, a landslide victory for LSU. But I want to get into some analytics, some details, not that there's a whole lot to figure out. It was pretty much an ass-kicking. But let's talk about this LSU-Clemson matchup and breakdown. To start off, I mean, we always start this the analytics with the missed tackle breakdown, and both teams had double-digit missed tackles. So you could expect that with the skill both teams have on offense. There's going to be some missed tackles. Those are some pretty dynamic players. Both teams had 10 missed tackles, so kind of a wash, kind of expected. I mean, you're not going to have three missed tackles when you're going against Ja'Marr Chase and Justin Jefferson, or Travis Etienne and T. Higgins and Justin Ross. It's just not going to happen, or shouldn't happen, and if it is, that's ridiculous. But what you really saw was probably one of the best offenses in the history of college football, if not the best. And next episode, I'm going to really talk about how it compares to, let's say, the last 20 years of college football, because wow. Wow. 628 yards, 42 points, zero turnovers. And as the hat says, Joe Big Dick Burrow. Buy the hat, by the way. Buy it. As he threw it on in the locker room post game, had a day. Now, I will say this. It wasn't a perfect game as a whole for LSU on offense. I mean, Joe Burrow was sacked 5 times. That was 10% of his dropbacks. He was sacked. He was pressured 16 times. They were 4 of 13 on third down. So it wasn't a flawless and perfect game. But, big, big but. Joe Burrow, as I said in the preview, there's no answer for him. There's not. The best thing that Clemson did was what I said they would do. Simulated pressure. Show blitz, but don't bring more than 4. That's the only thing they did that was really effective. Because Joe Burrow, when he was blitzed with 5 or more, his effectivity throwing the ball increased by 12%. He was 58.6% completion when it was base defense. And when he was blitzed, he was 70%. Think about this. When Joe Burrow was blitzed in the national championship game, he threw 14 of 20, 250 yards, and 3 touchdowns. That's stupid. Now, I'll tell you what he did do, and I've been saying it all year. He was 0 for 3 on deep balls to his left and 4 for 4 on deep balls to his right. And we talked about it. That's because of the dominant eye, dominant hand, right? What hand is stopping the ball in the catch? What eye is your dominant eye? What eye do you have best vision out of? Is that your left eye? When the ball's coming from the receiver's left, can he see it better and track it better? Something that is not talked about a lot. Dominant eye, dominant hand catch. Joe Burrow was 0 for 3 to the left, 4 for 4 to the right on deep balls. And the 4 for, I think he had 3 touchdowns to his right. How about this though? 21 of his attempts, almost half of all of his attempts were between the hashes under 10 yards. This is how you have success. You have high efficient passes, you know, just little 5-yard drag routes, little slants, things like that to keep the momentum and the juice flowing. And then you launch it down the field to a freak show and score a touchdown. That is the most effective offense. 21 of his attempts, 24 of 31 under 10 yards for 266 yards. 24 completions out of 31 were under 10 yards for almost 300 yards. And I said the only thing that worked was simulated pressure when they got home. And they did. It wasn't a great game. Now, what I was surprised about was this was not a mismatch game plan. LSU said one thing. You don't have anyone that can cover us and stop Joe Burrow when he throws to Ja'Marr Chase or Justin Jefferson or Terrace Marshall. You don't. A.J. Terrell and Darian Kendrick, right? They were the two corners for Clemson. They're island corners. A.J. Terrell gave up 143 yards and 2 touchdowns. Darian Kendrick gave up 114 yards and 3 touchdowns. So LSU was not afraid to go after their dogs. There was no mismatches on the stiff safeties. No. They said, we don't care. We're running our offense. We are better than you. And they were a lot better. This Clemson defense could not handle LSU's offense. So I'm really excited next episode to talk about kind of where this offense lands in the history of offensive football, because if it's not at the top, it's right up there. And then LSU on defense and Clemson on offense. This LSU defense was so much better down the stretch of this championship run than they were mid-season, even two-thirds of the way into the season when they play Ole Miss and give up a million yards. I mean, 1 of 11 on third down. And what they did was what Ohio State did. They shut down the Clemson Twin Towers, as I call them. And here's why. And here's what happened at Ohio State. I'm at Ohio State in 2012-2013. The Big Ten is severely down, especially at skill. And I have these receivers that are really good players. They're not maximized yet. But what you saw was these receivers. Devin Smith was a classic example in 2013. He got away with so much, because he was playing below average players that he would still shine on Saturdays. The competition was so much lower than his ability, he would still be very productive and play very well. And I used to tell him all the time, it's going to bite you in the ass. And what you have to do as a coaching staff is, because what happens? Eventually you play someone with good corners. For us, it was Michigan State in 2013. They had two first rounders. And all of a sudden, you're exposed. You can't get open. You can't do what you normally do because you weren't training to go against Jeff Okuda. You weren't training to go against Richard Sherman or a great corner. You were training to get away with sloppy shit against average talent. When that talent gap is not there, you get exposed. And that's what happened to Clemson. And what they need to do now is reevaluate how much competitive one-on-ones their receivers and DBs were doing throughout the year. Because in 2014, one of the biggest things I did differently and we did differently was we made the receivers and DBs go against each other all the time, because that was when they were going to refine their craft. Michael Thomas needed to go against Eli Apple and Gerrion Conley and Marshawn Lattimore. So he could go against first rounders so much that when we played Alabama, Devin Smith could go for a touchdown and two big plays and Mike Thomas could light the scoreboard up. But that was not going to happen against Indiana. It comes down to practice prep. If you aren't going to see it on Saturdays during the season, you better see it on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday against your own secondary. Or when you do see it in the postseason, you're like a rusty tool that hasn't been sharpened. You're like a deer in headlights. You're like, oh shit, that sloppy technique that I was using isn't working anymore. And that's what happened to T. Higgins and Justin Ross. They got away with so much all year. And when they played Ohio State, when they played LSU, now they're facing NFL corners and they can't get it done. The other thing that happened was Trevor Lawrence was off. I mean, he just was off. That early season struggles kind of reared its head again. 2 of 7 over 20 yards, so the deep ball wasn't working. That was as much on his receivers as him. He was 2 of 12 outside the hashes. 2 of 12. I don't have that stat, whatever, divided out. 1 divided by 6. That is not good. He threw the ball 26 times versus a base defense. No blitz, no pressure. Base defense. He completed 42% of those passes for 77 total yards. He averaged 3.7 yards per attempt versus base defense. LSU didn't have to blitz him. They were locking up the perimeter, getting pressure with a four-man rush, and he was getting 3.7 yards every time he attempted a pass. That is bad. It was an ass-kicking. I'm not going to go too much more into detail. I was going to go drive by drive, but it was like this was apparent that there was a few large issues that reared its head the whole game, and that's what we just went over. But that was the issue. That was what the game was. You had an absolute stud throwing the ball in LSU. You had freak shows catching everything on the perimeter for LSU. You had corners that couldn't cover those receivers for Clemson. And then you had one of the best quarterbacks in the country had a day off. He had an off day, didn't play well. You can't win a national championship when your quarterback doesn't play well. The receivers weren't getting open. Point blank simple. So you got to ask why, and that's what I just went over. Why? Why did that happen to two receivers that did much better a year earlier against Alabama, against some big-time NFL corners? So it just goes back to preparation. How did they prepare? Did they get enough practice against NFL talent? I would say no. I bet they didn't. But the wild thing is, going back to my, and I'm so into this, is almost as much as missed tackles, dominant catch hand, dominant eyes, right? Both quarterbacks in the game were combined 0 for 8 to their left over 10 yards. Why? Because right-handed quarterbacks, it's harder to make a great throw to your blind side, and right-handed receivers, it's harder to stop the ball with your left hand. It just is what it is. The other thing I would be remiss not to mention is the SEC certainly was king this year. Unlike most people that talk football and analyze football, they won't admit when they were wrong. But as I said, this is a year-to-year issue. Last year, the SEC was not dominant. This year, they were. They proved to be dominant. LSU was the best team in the country. I think LSU-Ohio State would have been a closer game, but I don't know that anyone could have stopped Joe Burrow and the stuff Joe Brady was doing with him. I believe Ohio State could have slowed him down, and you're not going to stop him. You're going to have to outscore him, and maybe Justin Fields with an actual run game could have done that. I don't know. We'll never know, right? But the SEC certainly was king this year. Best conference in football, the Big Ten second, not even close. The ACC and Big 12 and Pac 12 are horrendous. But we'll talk about that a little later. In next episode. But what a game. What a season. What a career for Joe Burrow. And really excited to watch him at the next level because he has it, that it factor. You saw him with the stogie. Big Dick Joe with his hat on, showing how big his balls are. It was something else. Nothing worked against him. No game plan choice, no strategic and schematic plan was going to change the game. It was phenomenal. So congratulations, LSU Tigers. By and far the best team in the country. National champions, getting a ring, have a trophy coming back to Baton Rouge, and might be the best, if not one of the best, teams in college football history. But we're going to get a little insight from Clemson and inside the Clemson camp from Anna Hickey in 1 minute. We're going to take a quick break from one of our sponsors, and we'll be right back with Anna Hickey in the Clemson State of the Union. Okay, so we all know how a VPN protects your privacy and security online, right? But I didn't know this until recently, and it's taken my TV watching game to the next level. You can use a VPN to unlock movies and shows that are only available in other countries. Over the weekend, I used ExpressVPN to binge watch Fresh Prince of Bel-Air on Australian Netflix. It was so simple, I just fired up the ExpressVPN app, changed my location to Australia, refreshed Netflix, and that was it. See, ExpressVPN hides your IP address and lets you control where you want sites to think you're located. You can choose from almost 100 different countries. So just think about all the Netflix libraries you can go through. Do you love anime? Use ExpressVPN to access Japanese Netflix and be spirited away. And it's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service. Hulu, BBC iPlayer, YouTube, you name it. There are hundreds of VPNs out there, but the reason I use ExpressVPN to watch shows is it's ridiculously fast. There's never any buffering or lag, and you can stream in HD, no problem. ExpressVPN is also compatible with all your devices, phones, media consoles, smart TVs, and more. So you can watch what you want on the go or on the big screen, wherever you are. If you visit my special link right now, expressvpn.com/menace, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show, watch what you want, and protect yourself at expressvpn.com/menace. You won't regret it. All right, we are back on Menace to Sports with our resident Clemson insider now. At this point, you've been on so many times, it's almost like we need to send you a paycheck. Anna Hickey is back on the show. How are you, Anna?
I'm good. I'm back from New Orleans and dealing with a little bit of cold and sore throat, but it was worth it for that trip.
I would say that was 2 weeks of travel and chaos and games and just insanity. So I'd imagine it took a toll on you a little bit.
Yeah, it did. But I mean, now that the off season's kind of hit in and you look back at what I got to do and cover those two awesome games, incredible atmospheres. And I don't know. I mean, I've covered multiple playoffs before and postseason trips, but it never gets old. And I think especially we were talking about this before the podcast started, but just how freaking cool it was covering LSU winning a national championship in New Orleans. I mean, I just can't beat that.
I can't imagine. And we were talking about it, like Bourbon Street in New Orleans by itself, really crazy. Then you throw in the national championship, even crazier. And the fact that it was LSU and they won. I just can't even imagine the magnitude in New Orleans.
But, and then you have like Orgeron and Burrow. I mean, it just, You literally couldn't write anything cooler if you're an LSU fan.
No, no way. I mean, they are on cloud nine right now, as they should be. But tell me a little bit about the game. Obviously, you were there for it. Just the feeling during the game, the feeling kind of just around what was going on as LSU really was unstoppable. And as good as Brent Venables is, there was no answer for Joe Burrow in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, so first, I think just important to touch on like the lead up to the game. So Clemson was confident, but it was a quiet confidence. I mean, they've always been like that under Dabo Swinney. They're not going to come out and make any bold proclamations. Like they let them kind of like flying under the radar. You know, they were profusely praising LSU, whether it was the on-campus media day leading up to the New Orleans or the media day in New Orleans. It was just putting the LSU offense on a pedestal, you know, putting Dave Aranda on a pedestal. But then you could tell inside the program, I think that they were really confident in their plan. They liked, you know, the 2 weeks of preparation that they had, both offense and defense. And I think that they thought going in, you know, they would have to play really like probably unquestionably their best game of the season to win. But I don't think they went in the game thinking like, we're going to lose by 20 points.
Yeah.
No way. And now LSU on the flip side, they went into the game thinking they were going to win by 20 points. And they would tell you that too. To your face.
Right.
Which, I mean, it was incredible. I mean, like just talking to the LSU players at media day, they were so confident and you almost thought like, hey, like this is going to come back and bite them. You know, I mean, they are just so confident right now. It's like, they think they're untouchable. I mean, this Clemson team has won 29 games in a row. They just beat Ohio State, who a lot of people thought was the most complete team in the country entering the playoff. And LSU is just like, yeah, I mean, as long as we go out there and take business, no one's going to stop us.
Right.
And they were just so outspoken about it. And then they went and they did exactly what they told you they were going to do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one thing to talk trash against Oklahoma or leading up to that game, because Oklahoma, I mean, they're not a top 10 team.
Right.
So, another thing to do it in the national championship against Clemson. And I mean, Trevor Lawrence and Brent Venables, and they just didn't bat an eye. And I mean, I don't know if we'll ever see anything like that again in college football. I don't know if I'll ever see anything like LSU's 2019 offense again. I mean, I don't know if anyone's ever going to be able to replicate that.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely they had it all cooking. I mean, on all fronts.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing they didn't have all year was a solid defense. And towards the end, you know, the last 4 weeks, really, you watched a defense kind of simplify and just go out and play. And they were much improved. And that's all they needed. They had the offense. They had the most ridiculous offense I've seen in a long time. And all they needed was just give them some sort of a defense to play with. And they got a chance to beat anybody by 20. And that's definitely what you saw. What I really wanted to get your insight on was because we saw it all year. We saw the early struggles of Trevor Lawrence, and you and I discussed it several times about really that was just a growth process and less a struggle. It was more just giving him more, him dealing with making mistakes. And you saw it towards the end of the year, how much better he played. But in the last two games, he was really ineffective outside of with his feet against Ohio State at throwing the ball, and T. Higgins and Justin Ross and these players that just were transcendent the last 2 years and in last year's playoffs, they just really, they weren't the same players. Was it more game plan and execution by LSU, or was it kind of a chink in the armor that reared its head in this game?
So I think it's a little bit of both. With Trevor Lawrence, I would put less on, I know he didn't have a good game against LSU. That I think was obvious. Ohio State, it was kind of, the passing game was a little undershadowed just by the fact that Travis Etienne had those great plays, obviously, as a pass catcher, and then Lawrence with his legs, which like you mentioned. But I think it was more of the receivers aren't getting enough attention in this situation. Because Halfley talked about it after the Ohio State game, and then Aranda talked about it after the LSU game, and it was basically like no one in the ACC has had corners good enough to play press man against these wide receivers. They've all played off. They haven't really challenged Clemson's receivers, Higgins and Ross on the outside. And basically Lawrence has been able to just throw it up. They've been able to go up and get it. And Ohio State did it and LSU did it. And Clemson had some issues with it. And the other thing I think is they don't have a tight end like Jordan Leggett in the past, which that's been well documented. They had Braden Galloway who came back to the Ohio State game and he made a couple of plays against LSU, but then LSU kind of discovered, like, okay, maybe we should cover this guy. We didn't really know much about him. And so once they made those adjustments, he was shut down.
Yeah.
And then Amari Rodgers, as much as I think that he's a valuable player on this team, he's not your Hunter Renfro slot guy. No. He's not going to – that slippery guy that's going to blow by a Kerry Vincent in the slot. He just doesn't have that type of speed and separation. He's more – I mean, he's 5'10", 2 – I don't know how much he weighs, but he's built like a running back.
Yeah.
So – you know, he's better closer to the line of scrimmage. So if you're really covering Ross and Higgins on the outside, and if you take those two guys away, you're in trouble. And then the other thing is, too, what I thought was interesting from Miranda is he said this was our best, the best game all year for our four-man pass rush.
For which sure.
Was saying something. So they were able to get pressure with just four, and I think that was affecting Lawrence a little bit. And then the other thing, I'm surprised a little that Clemson went away from the run. Hindsight is 2020, and I know I'm not anything close to a play caller, but there was a couple times on some early downs that I thought they could have handed the ball off to ETN, especially because the front was getting a little bit of push on LSU's defense. That one touchdown drive, I think they ran it like 6 out of the 7 plays. And then after that, it just kind of seemed like they abandoned it a little bit. But yeah, overall, I think it was just a mix of everything. And not to slight Trevor, I still think he's a generational quarterback, and I don't think these last two games, you know, should shed light on otherwise. But I don't think his wide receivers did him any favors.
No doubt. And that's one of the things on an earlier segment when I kind of broke down the game that I talked about was Trevor Lawrence, or I mean, Travis Etienne. Ohio State did a phenomenal job of kind of shutting down the run game. The running back run game. They had to go to screens. They had to go to him out of the backfield.
They had to pull out everything absolutely in the book in order to beat Ohio State.
But yeah. I was shocked against LSU because it was almost like Clemson was afraid that might happen and just preconceived that was going to happen because Travis Etienne's averaging over 5 yards a carry, almost rushes for 100 yards. It was not the same ineffectivity as the Ohio State game, and I was kind of shocked that, like you said, that they went away from it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't really know there. There was like one. It was like they went on a slant to Ngata, and that was incomplete. And another one, and then right back into the air. And it was at that point, it was still a close game. And then you're already looking at 3rd and 10. And Clemson was 1 for 11 on 3rd down against LSU. Yeah, I mean, you are not going to win the game if that's the case. And the other thing is that none of those 3rd downs were under 4 yards. So most of them were 3rd and 8, 3rd and 9, 3rd and 10.
That's what.
So I mean. And then you allow LSU to get that speed on the field. I know they have that 3rd down package where they get all those crazy pass rushers out the line of scrimmage and they do all sorts of things. And I mean, you're just not going to convert like that, especially with the way the wide receivers, like I said, the wide receivers weren't creating a ton of separation and you knew you were going to have to pass the ball. So Clemson just kind of showed its hand there. So, I mean, I do think that there is some criticism. Normally I don't, you know, people always want to say run the ball, and I don't know if that's always valid, but this case, I do think there's some valid criticism for getting away from the run a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think the other thing that people won't talk about because of the 42 points, because of the 628 total yards. I mean, Joe Burrow just had a ridiculous game, 463 yards passing, 5 touchdowns, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is LSU wasn't actually effective on 3rd down. They weren't effective on keeping drives alive. I mean, they were 4 of 14, which is overshadowed by what you just said, Clemson 1 of 11. But as much as LSU, Joe Brady and Joe Burrow kind of got after Venables and the defense, he didn't do a bad job getting them off the field when it came to money downs.
No.
It was big plays in the pass game just lit them up.
Big plays, yep. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't even necessarily like the guys that we thought were going to get burned in terms of Tanner Muse or Nolan Turner. I mean, it was their best corners, AJ and DK and Kendrick. And I just think Clemson did such a good job of taking other things away. They did a good job on Clyde in the passing game. Mm-hmm. And they had a good plan. But at the end of the day, I think it just shows, you know, it doesn't matter how well you scheme against LSU and what your plan is, their players are just better. And they showed that on Monday night.
And I mean, you watch the thing that I've keep mentioning, just in conversation on the show, everything is Joe Burrow had something at his disposal. And that was 3 receivers that when the ball was in the air, they came down with it. It didn't, like, there was plays in this game where AJ Terrell's in great coverage, but the play is made by the receiver simply. And it's right, not, it wasn't poor defense. It wasn't poor coverage. It wasn't a great throw. Right. It was just a freak of nature went up and got the ball. And it's just wild.
And Burrow just placed it. I mean, he's not like having to necessarily make any of these crazy acrobatic catches in the air or, you know, I mean, the ball was just so perfect every single time. It was just wild to watch.
Yeah, it was fun to watch as someone without a stake in any of it. That's for sure.
Sure, yeah.
But and Joe Burrow is, my God, what a year. So I want to take you back because of the Ohio State fans listening. I do want to talk to you just very briefly about the semifinal game and just your thoughts kind of now that you look back at it. I know there's been, I mean, ad nauseum discussion about the fumbles and touchdowns and targeting and all that. What was the feeling around Clemson around the game? I know my feeling was Ohio State lost the game on their own. The referees certainly played an impact, but that was not why they lost. It could have changed the game one way or another, but you can't drop two touchdowns or three touchdowns, really. You can't not score in the red zone. You can't do those things and beat Clemson, period. What was the feeling in Clemson kind of prior to the lead up to LSU, kind of the aftermath of the Ohio State win?
Well, it's interesting. As soon as after that game, it was kind of like Clemson went into this hole where we hardly got any media availability. We didn't get Dabo one time on campus in between the semifinal, those 2 weeks in between the semifinal and the final. So they really went under the radar and didn't come out and say a lot. I think inside they were probably pretty pissed off that there was so much discussion about the refs and,
yeah, for sure,
you know, that sort of thing. And like how, you know, Ohio State was the better team, but the refs just blew it. I'm sure that was just, you know, that was going through their minds, but they definitely didn't come out and say it. I think after that game, they were honestly just so beat. I mean, we talked to Dabo the day after. He said, you know, the coaches are sore, like everybody's sore. Trevor Lawrence said it was the most physical game he's ever played in. And, you know, I think people took that to knock it on the ACC schedule, which I don't really think that's the takeaway there. I mean, I think if you ask Ohio State, they would have said it was a super physical game too. You know, I think it was just two really, really good teams going at it and emptying the tank. And I think if you ask Clemson, a lot of the guys, even though they were still banged up, they would have rather played that LSU game the very next weekend. I think they were kind of, you know, hitting the mouth and it was like, all right, you know, it's kind of that woke us up a little bit. We were just cruising through our regular season schedule. Kind of like we went to war and back. Now let's just keep this thing going. But so I don't know how the 2 week layoff really affected them. I know it allowed them to get a little bit more healthy, but I almost think those guys were just ready to keep playing.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure once they got their bodies back after 3 or 4 days, they were just ready to go play for it all. That waiting period is awful. And it's even worse for the semifinal because it's like a month. That 2 week break there was certainly not without anxiety.
Yeah. No, and even for reporters, it was like how many ways can I preview this game? Like I feel like I talked about Clemson LSU for forever, but
oh, absolutely. Well, so just kind of now outside of football, talk to me about the two different venues. Talk to me about Phoenix. Talk to me about New Orleans. Kind of compare the two and just kind of how was your experience personally?
Yeah, I don't know how much people care about my experience, but Phoenix was awesome just because the media hotel there is the Camelback Inn and Resort. So it's a JW property. Ooh. And it's just, I mean, it was incredible.
Yeah.
I felt like I was like on vacation half the time out there. So, that was cool. And then, I mean, Ohio State fans just traveled so well. So, I mean, it was cool seeing that. And the downtown Phoenix area is a lot of fun. So, I mean, I had a blast on that trip. But when I told you this before, I mean, the game, Clemson-Ohio State, obviously, was the better game than Clemson-LSU in terms of it being close and entertaining.
Yeah.
But the atmosphere in New Orleans – when LSU's playing for a national championship, I mean, that's something that I'll never forget. And I've covered so many postseason trips with Clemson now that you almost think they would start to run together and kind of get old after a while, but they really don't. And I think this last trip might have been my favorite. I mean, just seeing how happy the LSU fan base was. I mean, you have such a storybook ending, and it was almost like going into that game that, yeah, I mean, I predicted LSU by 7. But I thought for sure Clemson had the horses to win, and I really didn't know which way it would go. But once the game got started and LSU started pulling away, it was almost like, why did we ever think anything but this was going to happen?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Like, it was just kind of like everything all season was coming up LSU. You have Joe Burrow, 15-0, Heisman winner, national champion, and then he's about to be number one in the NFL draft. I mean, you can't get it any better than that. So yeah. I just think that it was just written. It was destiny for them this year. And then just seeing LSU fans in New Orleans before the game, after the game, they hadn't done it in a while, and then to beat Bama, they kind of been in the shadow of Bama for a while. Even Clemson, and Clemson, Alabama was all we were talking about. And even Georgia was kind of always mentioned as that third team right there. And then Ohio State and LSU just kind of came out of, I don't say nowhere, but they were not predicted this season to win it all by any means.
Oh, no.
So it's just an awesome, if you like college sports, if you like college football, I don't know how you can hate on what LSU did this season and being able to do it all in their home state.
No, that's why you got to love the sport, because a team like that can come along and have such a magical season that no one saw coming, and no one did. You're right. I mean, no one saw Joe Burrow having this year that LSU could beat Alabama or then survive Georgia or then survive Ohio State or Clemson, or no one saw that coming. And it's just really magical.
And nowadays, it's like what we're taught, our college athletes are taught, you know, not to necessarily always speak their mind and kind of always compliment the opponents. And, you know, I kind of like that, how much swag LSU has. And now, is it going to work every year for them to be like that? No. But it was just the identity of this team to have that much confidence. And kind of reminded me, you know, just like some of the Miami teams or back in the day where it was just like, they just had so much swag all across the board. And you just don't see that a lot. I don't think, where a team just literally thinks they're that unstoppable.
No doubt. Well, it was definitely really cool to watch. And it was a great ending, especially for someone like Joe Burrow, who I know well, and Ohio State fans know well. So it was, you know, we were glad for him. I was glad for him.
Sure. Yeah.
But so just now transitioning, season's over, and I kind of took this week, and this is my first show since the national championship game, because I wanted to take a couple days, let everyone talk about it all, and then get back to where we are today. And the reality is, we are, 11 months and 20 days away from next year's national championship, and everyone in the country right now has really pinned two teams as the two teams that should be there, Clemson, Ohio State, again. And I'm just curious, kind of the team that is going to be left in Clemson, who's leaving, who you see stepping up, who is going to be the 2020 Clemson Tigers?
So Trevor Lawrence coming back, obviously that's going to be your centerpiece. And then Justin Ross at wide receiver, Amari Rodgers, T. Higgins declared yesterday. And then you have two freshmen, Joe Ngata and Frank Latson, and they're expected to step up at receiver. Mm-hmm. Now you do replace, and I think this is kind of going under the radar a little bit, you do replace four of your five starting offensive linemen, and that is a big deal because these guys were all veterans and had been there and done that. They were staples in multiple college football playoff runs. So, you know, Clemson will be fine there, but I do think that's something to definitely keep an eye on. Mm-hmm. And then defensively, they should be much improved along the defensive front. They're older, more experienced, and then you get that influx from the class of 2020, just that insane D-line haul that Clemson signed.
Yeah, insane.
They're going to be young, but they're going to be able to contribute just by how talented a couple of those guys are. And I think you'll see more of the four down than we did this year with Venables kind of changing up scheme based on his personnel. And then Jamie Skalski returns, the linebacker that got ejected for targeting against LSU. So that's huge. Isaiah Simmons and Chad Smith, the other two starting linebackers, they're gone. But Clemson, I think Clemson will be fine at linebacker. Other than the fact that you're losing Simmons, that's huge.
Yeah, you're never going to replace him. But
I think that'll be interesting. That's one of the more positions that I'm probably more interested in, because there's really no obvious backup there. And Venables is going to have to change something. I mean, you can't just not just another Isaiah Simmons in waiting, where you can be like, all right, you're just gonna do all the same things Isaiah did last year. So you're gonna have to change some tweak some things there. And then on the back end, you lose both safeties, and then you lose AJ, the cornerback, but you return the other cornerback. So I don't know, they're gonna be kind of inexperienced on the back end, but should be better on the front end. So I don't know. You know, I'm not sold on Clemson. I think Clemson has the best odds right now right?
Yeah, I mean,
to win it all.
I mean, when you have the projected number one overall pick at quarterback.
Right, and the other
thing, too, is like the
other quarterbacks coming back. I mean, it's who are the other quarterbacks? Fields and Lawrence.
And I mean, you could say Mac Jones at Alabama if you want to.
But you don't have like these huge names returning at quarterback or even at running back next year. So I think this year was just so many talented teams at the top, especially those top three, Ohio State, Clemson, LSU, and then even Alabama when you have a healthy Tua. So I don't know if we're going to see that much at the top next year.
Yeah, I think next year is going to be a huge question mark outside of Clemson, Ohio State. Everyone will assume that they will be the teams to beat mainly because of the quarterback situation, but you're going to have an opportunity for a Florida to sneak in the conversation.
Yeah,
And you're always going to have to count on Alabama to be relevant. LSU, it'll be interesting to see what they do with Joe Brady and Joe Burrow both gone. So it's going to be interesting.
Were they losing like 14 or 15 starters?
I mean, basically everyone.
Yeah, everyone's declaring for the draft.
Especially after Odell passed some money around. They might have a lot of supplemental drafts. And
yeah, exactly.
Who
yeah.
knows what's going to go down in Baton Rouge after that. But
the other thing I would mention is there's a little bit of chatter, and it might be irrelevant by the time this podcast runs, but that Travis Etienne is seriously mulling the decision of coming back.
Ooh.
And that would be crazy if he did. I think that we talked to Tony Elliott after the game, and he kind of made it seem like this is not a foregone conclusion. There's obviously at the running back position, there's not a lot of longevity in the NFL in terms of second shot contracts and then just how much tread is on your tires at the position. But then he also countered that saying, this is a really deep running back class. So, I mean, it's not like Travis, he's played 3 years and he's averaged under 14 carries a year. I think he averaged like 8 his first year. And then these past 2 years, it was like 13.5 and 13.8. So, I mean, he's not beaten down by any stretch, but I still think it'd be pretty shocking. Or at least surprising if he does elect to return.
I'd be shocked, and I'm sure he doesn't listen, but let me give him my ploy to come back because I
to come back.
Here's why he should. Okay. And though I think he's the best running back in the country, I've said it for three months now. I do believe that. I don't believe he'll get selected high in the first round. I think he'll be a second rounder more than likely, which is a crime in my opinion. And with the gauntlet schedule that Clemson plays, he will be able to have a phenomenal year next year. With a potential national championship, potential end of the season awards that I thought he should have won this year. And then he'll be in the conversation in a much lesser running back draft class to go 15th overall or whatever. And the financial benefit for him, and he doesn't have to go play Alabama, Georgia, Florida. He doesn't have to play those teams week in, week out. He's going to play the ACC, which no offense, he'll be able to have great games, be out in the middle of the third quarter and have a great year. And it would be a smart investment. So Travis.
And he doesn't have any injury history,
right.
You know, so it's not like he's worried about, not that he can't get injured, but he doesn't have these nagging issues where it's like, he's got to take his chances now.
No, and he was good enough this year that he'll get a nice insurance policy. And Travis is not listening, but if he did, that's what I would tell him. And selfishly,
go ahead of him this draft.
I don't know.
Running back wise.
I mean, they're going to say Jonathan Taylor. They're going to say maybe
Swift.
Maybe probably DeAndre Swift. And then I put Travis Etienne at one, and everyone knows that I think that. But I think that he might be the third or fourth. You could slide JK in there maybe, but I doubt it.
Clyde Edwards is such a hot name, but I don't know where. He's so small, I don't know.
I don't see that. I mean, to be honest with you, I think I think Travis is the best running back in the country this past year, especially with what he can do out of the backfield, a la kind of Alvin Kamara-ish. NFL people are pretty stupid, in my opinion. I mean, they'll take Jonathan Taylor, and not that he's not a great player, but they'll take Jonathan Taylor, probably DeAndre Swift, and then maybe JK in the first round, if that. There might only be two first-round running backs.
Yeah. So, I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen. I mean, I think the deadline is January 20th. So, what is that? Is that Monday?
Yeah, Monday.
So, I don't know. If these next couple of days go by and we don't hear anything, I think – you can pretty much say he's definitely seriously considering it. Not necessarily that he's definitely coming back, but just that there's definitely a decision on the table because he saw T declare yesterday. Wouldn't be surprising if we hear something from AJ today. Isaiah has already on the record saying he's gone. So AJ and Travis are really the guys that we're waiting on, and we pretty much know AJ's gone. So Travis is definitely a decision that worth keeping your eye on.
Well, and just kind of a little bit behind the scenes thought and talking to a couple of the players this year at Ohio State, you're talking about wasted time preparing for millions of dollars. And so the 20th is the deadline, but they need to be flying out Friday to go to training facilities and get to work. And so it's not like they just have a bunch of time to figure it out. They really need to decide like now just to get going. So it'll be interesting. As a selfish college football fan, I hope he comes back. I don't think he's going to get the value he should get. So that's just my personal opinion, but we'll see what he does.
Yeah, there's so much difference in contract money in terms of front end of the first round end of the second round, or even back end of the first round. It's just, it's incredible how much difference it is.
So much difference. Well, as always, Anna, appreciate you coming on. If those of you that want all the Clemson insider info, it's Anna Hickey at AnnaH247 on Twitter. Make sure you hit her up, give her a follow, and you will get all the insider info from Clemson. So thank you, Anna, for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We will, I'm sure, talk again. So thanks again. All right, well, that's all we have for you for today. Thank you for tuning in and listening. Really appreciate Anna Hickey coming on. She's providing us great insight into Clemson and kind of behind the scenes. And I got a feeling that little matchup is not going away soon. So she is a huge asset to the show. So we appreciate, as always, her coming on. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Also want to mention we're gonna be doing our first exclusive call-in show for Patreon subscribers today. So 5 o'clock Eastern time, if you are a Patreon subscriber, shoot us your cell phone number, whatever question you have, whatever, and we'll get you on the show. We're going to record that this evening and probably put it out either late tonight or early tomorrow. But that is an exclusive call-in show just for Patreon subscribers. So if you're not a subscriber, check it out. Patreon.com/Menace2Society Podcast. It's going to be an exclusive weekly call-in show where the call-ins will come from subscribers and the audio will only be available to subscribers. So just trying to give back to our supporters. But anyways, thank you for tuning in. If you're interested in advertising and sponsorship, please reach out at Zach, Z-A-C-H, at Menace2Sports, the number 2.com. And look forward to the future of the show, enhancing and improving. So thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening. As always, we appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you were entertained. Hope you learned something. And if you didn't, as we say, go fuck yourself, San Diego.
That's why I don't read the newspaper, because it's garbage. And the editor that let it come out is garbage.
Or do you do what everybody else in the media does, just create some shit and throw it on the wall and see what sticks, which is what I see happening everywhere.
Where are we at in society today? I'm a man. I'm 40.
When my time on Earth is gone and my activities here are past, I want they bury me upside down and my critics can kiss my ass.